Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm your host, Boris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, Six Nations elected council will strongly oppose Doug Ford's government plans to convert 7,000 acres of Ontario's Green Belt into housing developments.
They're being forced upon our lands without proper consultation. Regardless of the Supreme Court of Canada decisions, our Crown's legal duty to consult in the First Nations.
6.9 million people across the country experienced food insecurity in Canada's top 10 provinces last year. Numbers in Nova Scotia are at an all-time high.
The family of four is getting around less than $1,200 a month. How do you find a place to rent with two children and two adults and have money for food? It starts to become impossible.
We'll go to British Columbia, where unemployment numbers in the Kootenay region seem to be higher than the national and provincial average.
Maybe there is a generation that's coming up that says, I don't want to work as much as I was, as much as my parents were previously.
And the Sky Dancer Indigenous Cultural Center and Art Gallery opens its doors in Spruce Grove, Alberta.
So it's a place where Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can come together and learn to understand each other. And it's basically helping everybody working toward truth and reconciliation. That's what it's all about today.
You're tuned into Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Happy to have you with us. We start things off in Oshawa, Ontario, where the Six Nations elected council says it will strongly oppose the proposed removal of green spaces within Ontario's Green Belt and will voice their concerns to the Auditor General of Ontario. The Ontario government announced in December of 2022 that it plans to remove or redesignate 15 areas of green space within the Green Belt to make way for housing developments in the near future. This would compromise some 7,400 acres of land. The move also infringes First Nations traditional treaty rights, says the Six Nations lands researcher Phil Montour, adding that some of the lands in question are part of the ongoing land claims litigation case Six Nations is currently involved in with both the provincial and federal governments. But yet, development is still moving forward. Here's Andrew Dow in Oshawa, Ontario.
This isn't just a real estate transaction. I mean, right. the issue here is far more important. You know, you're infringing on our treaty rights, and every time more immigration comes in, that's the biggest challenge to Indigenous rights across Canada. You know, they're being forced upon our lands without proper consultation, regardless of the Supreme Court of Canada decisions that express our Crown's legal duty to consult and accommodate First Nations, when there is known Indigenous issues on the lands. Many of these lands that we're talking about affected by the Green Belt, they've not only been part of serious research and claims filed with both Canada and Ontario over the past 47 years, they've been part of an ongoing litigation for 27 years, and they're before the courts today, and yet everything just goes along lickety-split, like there's nothing. You know, where's the legal obligation from Crown Ontario to sit down and actually not just consult and accommodate, actually negotiate with the First Nations, and that is us, the Six Nations, and that for these regional expansions. We have a legal obligation to the upcoming generations, and we're going to uphold that.
Montour says the government is not only failing Six Nations and other First Nations who have an obligation to protect the lands, but also making victims of the people buying these properties and only escalating the unresolved land claims cases.
You know, they're not only failing the Six Nations, the Grand River people, they're making victims of the people who are buying these properties. You know, all you're doing is compounding the unresolved land rights issues, and it's getting more and more complicated and complex. There's got to be some honor in this Crown to sit down and discuss these issues face to face with our nation. The government just can't fluff us off to the municipality, who then fluffs us off to developers, who are many of them from outside of our region, who really don't give a damn other than flip a house and get out of Dodge, like I said. We have obligations. Our treaties ensure that we must take care of these lands and the environment. It's part of our cultures. You know, it's in our marrow that we got to do these things, and we do it. But we've got to be listened to as we move forward. As far as I'm concerned, this legislation breaks the law. Simple. But you've got to sit down and deal with the CAP team, the consultation and accommodation policy team that's been worked on diligently by this council for our community to protect our interests. And that's been ignored. To sit down after it's passed and then call that consultation, you know, it's just an afterthought. And it's actually very belittling to be sitting here today and kind of respond to when the horse is out of the barn.
Councillor Sherry Lynn Hill spoke to the reasons for the Greenbelt being protected lands and says she's disappointed with the lack of consultation between the provincial government and First Nations and is not in support of the removal of the 15 green spaces within the Greenbelt.
I totally disagree with all this. And I think a lot of us First Nations do, without any consultation, well, any talks about how we feel. It doesn't even matter if it's us or even what I'm finding out, the Canadians that say anything that are refusing this. It doesn't seem like Mr. Ford even cares. So it really bothers me when I know there's a housing crisis. I know all that kind of stuff. I understand all that. But I think when you start doing the green belt, it's protected for a reason. It's not protected just because. It's a green space. It's farmland. It's forest. It's wetlands, watersheds. It's protected for a reason. It's not protected to make people's money in their pockets, those kinds of things.
Councillor Audrey Pellis-Bomberry says First Nations need to start being consulted on decisions being made by the government at the beginning stages of projects like this to help seek solutions and offer their voices to be heard by the provincial government.
We wouldn't be in this problem right now had First Nations in Ontario been consulted, engaged, and had their voices heard. There's over 133 First Nations in Ontario. And there is lots of people being affected by these decisions that are being made without our voices there. That's one of the biggest things that has to go on from here on in. This unilateral decision-making and without our voices has to stop because it's wrong. We need to be included because we are one of the most important or one of the largest by population reserves in Canada. And it's about time people listen to us.
Six Nations elected council passed the motion to provide the Auditor General of Ontario a written list of the community's concerns over the removal of the green spaces within Ontario's Greenbelt. The Auditor General of Ontario did not provide a date when the audit will be concluded, but said the audit will be released likely by the end of the calendar year.
That was Andrew Dow in Oshawakin, Ontario.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJR.
And to British Columbia, where unemployment numbers in the Kootenay region seem to be higher than the national and provincial average, Nelson is one of several cities that has been impacted by the rising unemployment rates. Throughout 2023, the unemployment rate in the Kootenays has been steadily increasing. At 5.5%, it has now surpassed the national average of 5.2% and the provincial average of 5%. While the numbers may sound concerning, Tom Thompson, the executive director of Nelson's Chamber of Commerce, says an unemployment rate between 4 and 6% is still a healthy number. Here he is with journalist Scott Onishak as they discuss the current labor climate in the Kootenays.
It's kind of interesting because we had been trending where we were one of the lower ones in British Columbia for a couple of months. In the wintertime, we were down to about 3.9% at one point. And I think in a one-month jump, it went to about 5.5%. So we are higher. And I don't know the exact cause other than I would think that there's more people coming into the job market right now. So university is out. And now they're back looking for more work. They could be away at university in Victoria or UBC or elsewhere. And they happen to come back to the Kootenays for the summer and they start looking for work. So more people in the workforce looking for work. And if those jobs aren't being filled, it's going to make the rate go a little bit higher than it had been. So
do you think that we can expect this trend to keep going up? You're right, it was down to 3.9 and then it's about a year ago. But in the last month, it's jumped a decent percentage, almost over a whole percent from April to May. Do you think we can expect it to continue to rise over the summer?
Hard to say whether it would continue to rise. I think there's going to be something that kind of levels off in that 5.5%, 6% range. then maybe it'll start going back down sometime in the fall as people start going back to school and they're not back looking for work. So if there's usually a certain number of jobs that are available, and your unemployment rate is dependent on how many people are actually looking for work. So I think the number of jobs has remained relatively flat for the last little while. We had a real problem with just finding people to work for all sorts of different industries, from the construction industry and a lot of the trades and just general labor. We had problems with the service industry, food and beverage, pubs, places like that, that were having a tough time finding servers. So I think we're kind of back to that level where it's leveled off. I think there's a certain number of jobs that are out there. Most jobs seem to be filled. There's not a lot of pent-up demand with people with help wanted signs on Baker Street any longer. So I think that's a good sign. I don't think there's any real concerns that we're going into any kind of a major problem with unemployment.
So to me, what I found interesting was that it was going up, and then I started looking into the stats, as I'm not, like I said, I'm not an expert, and then seeing that, oh, 5.5 really isn't very high at all historically. So is this a healthy number for our unemployment to be at right now?
Yeah, I think healthy is probably in that 4 to 6 range. And when we're below 4, it means there's really a problem with getting enough people into the workforce for the number of jobs that are out there. So I've lived through times in the Kootenays where we're up in the 12 and 13% range, which can be really problematic for the economy. But I think businesses are, you know, once the visitors start to arrive and we start to see more decent weather for the Kootenays in July and August and September roll around, and we start seeing visitor numbers come up, I think businesses will start going, well, we're back on track and we're having a pretty decent summer, and the labor shortage isn't as big a concern as it was this time last year, or even worse, 2 years ago.
Yeah, there was a couple of years there where it's up, like you said, in the teens. But is there anyone who suffers because of a low unemployment rate?
I think a lot of times when it gets really low, that means there's fewer people participating in the labor pool. And a lot of different businesses start to suffer when their employment rate gets too low. I mean, you need to have people that are willing to work, and you need to have jobs that are available. And if there's more jobs that are available than people that are willing to work, then it becomes a problem for the local economy. And you've got businesses that have to shut down.
You hear it again and again from different people. Young people don't want to work. Do you think that's the case? And if it is, how can we get more young people working in those industries?
Try to make it as attractive as possible to work there. A lot of times they're considered entry-level jobs. And if you're willing to take an entry-level job and get some experience, you won't be long at an entry-level job. You'll soon be working into a higher-level server at a different food and beverage location. I mean, those are fun jobs for a lot of people of certain ages. And if you can get into them, there's nothing the matter with getting started in those. It seems like we're really fortunate that we're in a place like Nelson that has two campuses with Selkirk College. And then you've got the business Selkirk College campus down in Castlegar. And there's close to 600, 700 international students. And if you notice in the workforce, there's a lot of international students that are filling some of those service level jobs. So it's not like people don't want to work them, but maybe there is a generation that's coming up that says, I don't want to work as much as I was, as much as my parents were previously. Money just doesn't seem to be as motivating.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I love that idea that I'd like my lifestyle more than those jobs, but with how expensive living is here, it's like, how do you even have a lifestyle without working?
Well, that's a real catch point, I think. You know, sometimes, and I guess we can't paint everybody with the same brush, you know, there's a lot of people that have a really good work ethic at a young age, and, you know, they continue to show that throughout the rest of their career. But the days of even people that are physicians, highly educated individuals, there used to be a time when a lot of those physicians would work 70 and 80 hours a week. And I think some of the younger generation that's coming up saying, I'm still a really highly qualified physician and I'd like to continue to work, but I also like to have some kind of balance in my life. So I may only work 50 hours in a week. So if a physician retires because of just aging out of the workforce, quite often it takes two people to replace that one individual. So I think in the future, there's going to be a lot of job opportunities. There's, you know, for the younger generation, there's going to be lots to choose from. We have an older demographic. There's more people that are aging out of the workforce than are coming into the workforce. So it should mean for better days ahead for job choices. But it also means some of these jobs are going to have to be filled by people immigrating to the country and not necessarily homegrown talent filling all of the jobs. There's just not as many young Canadians coming into the workforce as there is older Canadians moving out of it.
That's a good point for sure. But anyway, Tom, I appreciate your time. I'm going to have to let you go here. Thanks again for doing the interview.
Sure. Thanks very much for your interest. Take care, man.
All right. You too.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
And to the Maritimes now, where recent data produced by Proof, a research program at the University of Toronto, has shown that food insecurity in Nova Scotia is at an all-time high. It was up 5% in 2022 from the previous year and 21% from before the COVID-19 pandemic. 6.9 million people across the country, including almost 1.8 million children, experienced food insecurity in Canada's top 10 provinces in 2022. The percentage of people living in food insecure households has increased in every province since 2019. However, the highest percentage of individuals experiencing food insecurity is in the Atlantic provinces due to the high rates of inflation and unemployment. In 2022, Nova Scotia's unemployment rate was 7%. Wendy Fraser, executive director of the North Grove Affordable Food Market, says one simple word can explain why the food insecurity levels are so high in Nova Scotia.
Poverty. Really, at the end of the day, this is about poverty. You know, I was had another interview yesterday, and there was a conversation about, you know, food insecurity or housing insecurity. They're secondary issues. They're secondary issues to the fact that there's significant poverty. So, you know, there's been minimal social assistance increases. A family of four is getting around less than $1,200 a month. How do you find a place to rent with two children and two adults and have money for food? It starts to become impossible. You know, our kind of social safety net has not kept up. There's also people who are just marginally employed. So they're employed, but they're employed in low income positions. And then, you know, we're not doing anything to manage housing costs. So they can't then, you know, having a roof over your head is the first priority. So then food becomes the second priority. So all of it really, in my mind, is about people having access to a living wage. So, you know, will there be a cost? Yes. But right now, what we did, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, built a housing that was affordable. And social assistance rates, some of the social assistance rates, and it went up 2% last time. We know that that's nowhere near keeping pace with inflation. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is the people who are struggling the most are being left further and further behind. And then the not-for-profits are becoming kind of the support system to try and fix it. Well, you know, we're also, our costs are going up and up and up, and our, you know, dollars we're fundraising are going up and up and up. It can't, it's still outpacing us.
Did the pandemic exacerbate this? I guess just with all.
Well, in some ways it did, and in some ways it actually made it easier for a bit. So, you know, when we look at the at our numbers and stuff, when people had access to CERB, it really created that guaranteed basic income. Mm-hmm. And so the usage went down for us. There were people, you know, during the pandemic, we just turned into a food distribution site. Our whole model changed. And we were giving food away for free because just managing the money of it all and how many people could come out was just too complicated. And lots of people stopped coming. And what we basically heard was they figured they could manage, but they would leave it for others who couldn't. But then as people ran out of CERB, it wasn't renewed, people had money back, all of that. And then, you know, this last year of inflation, it's just completely out of hand. Like there's no way for people to be able to afford on fixed income of any sort current food costs. It just can't. Our trading cupboard has increased over 200%. So, you know, we were regularly having around 43 people in a month who would use the trading cupboard, and now it's more like 160, something like that. I don't have the exact number, but I know it's over 200% increase. The stress is unbelievable for folks. Right, to not think that you can feed yourself or feed your child, it just creates a whole nother layer in terms of mental health challenges. If children aren't well fed, they're not learning. So it's impacting ultimately school outcomes at the end of the day, because it's going to impact their ability to learn, their actual physical overall long-term health in terms of their lives, how much they grow, how well they grow. All those things are impacted by not having access to secure access to food. You know, oftentimes we talk about hoping that we can work ourselves out of business because we can actually advocate for a stronger food system and get to a new place with it. But in fact, we've never been needed more.
That was Wendy Fraser, Executive Director of the North Grove and Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, speaking with journalist Haley DiRizio in Halifax. The North Grove Community Center is one of 12 across the country. And people who are feeling the pinch could get a little help from the Too Good To Go food app, which just launched in Halifax. Founded in Denmark in 2016, the app was created to help lower food wastage. It hit the Canadian market in 2021. It is now available in 16 cities across the country, Halifax being its latest market. The app connects businesses to consumers to sell surplus food at a discount, most of the time at a 60% discount. A report produced by the organization Made in CA shows that Canada creates 15 million tons of food waste every year. The app's main goal is to reduce food wastage globally, but the company says the reduced prices can also help those experiencing food insecurity. On that, here's Sarah Sodaroff, Senior PR Manager for Too Good To Go North America.
Food insecurity and surplus food waste, while parallel, are not exactly the same issue. So what we're working to do is to reduce surplus food waste. That's our primary mission. We do sell food at a discount. So that food is a heavily reduced price. On average, it's one third. It can be more. It can be a little bit less based on what you're getting in the bag. So if you think about it, if you buy a huge produce bag that is $5.99 on the app, you're getting three times that amount in your bag. So that's a fantastic way for people to reduce the food costs that they're exorbitantly increasing with inflation and rising food prices. We also know that there's always been a huge problem with food insecurity in our country, even though we do have a lot of access to food. Food prices are high, and as a result of the pandemic, there has been an increasing amount of people who are looking for food and food at a more reasonable price. We work with charity partners across the country to ensure that we are helping to meet that need. We have an in-app donation feature. So if you go into the app, it's geo-targeted. You'll see the charity partner that we work with and the not-for-profit partner that we work with that is closest to you, and you can donate monetarily within there. We also encourage our partners, if they have a breadth of food that is large enough that they can donate first before putting it on the app. The struggle with that often is that the amount of food that they have, that partners that we work with have, tend to be one or two items, five items, and that amount can't be donated. And the frequency of that donation is much shorter than what the food banks are looking for. So we do definitely want to help to tackle that problem. We want to work with charity partners across the country to better meet that demand and that supply. And we do call on the government to help lessen the restrictions around what can be donated so that we can get that great food that is edible into the hands of people who want it.
Thanks to Haley DiRizio for this excerpt.
You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
And we turn our eyes and ears towards Alberta to close up the show. The Sky Dancer Indigenous Cultural Center and Art Gallery has just opened in Spruce Grove, Alberta. The idea came from Diane Melly. She submitted her dream of a cultural center to the Spruce Grove City Council. The support from the City Council was unanimous, and the Sky Dancer Indigenous Cultural Center Society got some funds to make her dream come true. The cultural center, which opened on June 21st, is located in the Rotary Centennial Park on the west end of Spruce Grove, just outside Edmonton. It's a small building which features an art gallery filled with handmade paintings and pottery, as well as a porch for people to gather on. Diane Melly, president of the Sky Dancer Indigenous Cultural Center, says it's a place where Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can come together and learn to understand each other. Ryan Hunt has this story for us.
The Skydancer Indigenous Cultural Center and Art Gallery in Spruce Grove had their grand opening on National Indigenous Peoples Day on June 21st, which saw a ribbon-cutting ceremony attended by the mayor of Spruce Grove, as well as other dignitaries from Stony Plain and Parkland County. Diane Mealy, the president of the Skydancer Indigenous Cultural Society, explained what was happening that afternoon.
We are having the grand opening of Skydancer Indigenous Cultural Center and Art Gallery, which is a little art gallery that's small but mighty. It's filled with Indigenous art, all handmade, nothing mass-produced. It's also a cultural center, so it's a place where Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can come together and learn to understand each other, and it's basically helping everybody working toward truth and reconciliation. That's what it's all about today.
Mealy goes on to talk about the humble beginnings her and her team had and how the cultural center came to be.
We started in January of 22, and I spoke with a mayor of Spruce Grove and just said, I had this dream of a cultural center and would they back it up? Could they see something like that? And at first I just said it'll be an office with me sitting in it on the phone, getting people to come to events or like to workshops. And then they got behind it and gave us quite a nice grant, helped us to rent this place, which is right on Highway 16. So we have mega traffic and people stop in all the time. They're amazed by the colorful art inside. So it took about a year and a bit, and here we are, from talking about it to renting this place and moving in March.
Now that the opening has passed, Mealy has her sights fully set on the future.
We got so much planned. This is just the beginning. We have physical fitness workshops. We want to empower especially young Indigenous women and girls. So we are going to have some outdoor skills for them, taking them out on the land, getting them to make their own shelters, learning how to be in the cold, basically, and to trust themselves. In July, we have drum making. In August, we have sweetgrass and sage teachings. We have a bead worker coming. She's the artist in residence for Alberta right now, Sharon Kootenay. And the list just goes on and on. Come September, when it gets a little cooler, we'll have storytelling around the fire in the back. And that'll just be like on Friday evenings. We have singers that are going to start just singing around the fire. And so it's just a real community hub. And it's a safe place for everybody.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists Ryan Hunt, Haley DiRizio, Andrew Dow, and Scott Onishak. National editors Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.